The idea is building out this circular system where we take waste feedstocks, we grow the bacteria on those waste feedstocks, combine that with the textile and other ingredients to make this new material, which can then circle back into that system to create a closed loop.
That's Jen Keane speaking, CEO and founder of Modern Synthesis, a biomaterial innovation company. The materials Jen's company creates are grown using bacteria, actually similar bacteria to those you can find in yogurt or kombucha. This bacteria can make innovative new materials which can have a positive impact on our environment, and they can also come with a lower carbon footprint. With that, hello everyone and welcome to WGSN's Create Tomorrow podcast with a special edition about crafting the next generation of materials with biology and what they mean for the future of our world. I'm your host, Helen Palmer, Head of Materials at WGSN, and I'm also joined today by Lucila Saldana, WGSN's Footwear and Accessories Editor. As mentioned, today's guest is Jen Keane. Jen, it's a real pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. No, it's a pleasure to join. We've been, you know, chatting for years, actually, since I did my MA project. So it's great to be able to share more about our journey and where we are now with you and the rest of the team.
Brilliant. Yes, I think I was thinking back and casting my mind back. I think it was to 2018. I remember so clearly your master's material futures thesis project. This has grown and it really blew me away. It was probably the kind of stole the show in a way, and it really resonated with me. And I know that we highlighted your sneaker upper in our materials forecast that year. So it's something that has stayed with us, and we have definitely been following your progress over the years. And I think fast forward 5 years and you've come quite a long way, I think, since then, with a growing team and a new factory, microfracturing facility. And we'll talk about that a bit later. But first, it'd be good to just sort of talk about the biomaterial itself, because the thing I loved about it is the way you describe the process. And you say it's about you weaving the warp while the bacteria grows the weft. So what does that mean exactly?
It's interesting because we talk now versus 5 years ago, and sort of the analogies have changed as the technology itself has changed. And so originally with the This Has Grown project and the original shoe, the analogy came out of a way to help explain to designers and to textile people really how this was working, because it was so fundamentally new. And I think bacteria scared a lot of people. They still scare a lot of people. But trying to say what role these bacteria are playing in the story was really important. Because the material itself is not bacteria. You're not wearing a bacteria. You're not wearing a living organism. We're collaborating with an incredible organism to create the materials. And we've been doing that for centuries with other organisms. If we think about other materials like wool or even plants with cotton and whatnot, we're working with other organisms to create these. So with that analogy, it was kind of showing, you know, we're doing part of this, and there's a lot of human ingenuity that goes into these new processes, but also the organism itself has a role to play and the importance of that. And now that we've kind of transitioned a bit and we've got a company and we've learned a lot more and developed the technology, we're actually opened our eyes to kind of wider possibilities. And so we're going to start to kind of segment a little bit out as we start, you know, announcing different products and things over the coming years, where actually there's a bit more nuance than just the original microbial weaving, which is really exciting.
Okay, so basically from that initial concept, you're really sort of broadening out the possibilities of the material from that. That's really amazing. Now over to you, Lucila.
As a designer, as I said, I was a footwear designer before, and I was actually working on a sustainable project. But then your project launched, and I was first fascinated, and I really thought that was going to change the future of footwear to some extent. So basically what I want to ask is, I know you mentioned you started your career in sportswear, and obviously sportswear is so surrounded by petrochemicals, synthetics, different sort of materials that are man-made. So I want to understand, how was your journey and what was the beginning to completely swap from these synthetics to the microbial alternative materials? How was that beginning?
Definitely. I mean, that was the challenge, right? So I worked for Adidas for many years in Germany, and I was mostly actually on the apparel side initially, and then worked a little bit collaborating with all teams in my role within the creative direction team there, what we saw was, you know, there weren't other alternatives. Like, as you said, everything was made of synthetic polymers for the most part. There was sort of an introduction, and this was kind of the beginnings of regenerated cellulosics and trying to get the performance qualities out of those, but there wasn't many options even there. And the distance in terms of like the performance standards that had become industry standards or expectations for the product were a real challenge for natural materials, because we'd built up this whole understanding of what a product should do and what quality actually means. And I think that was, and still is, a big shift in mindset that we're going to have to overcome, is these products that we're wearing today, they'll last 1,000 years. And yes, we have rigorous quality tests so that make sure that they last, you know, the lifetime of the product. But the reality is they're going to last a lot longer than that. And so we kind of need to rethink not just the useful life, but think of the full life cycle of those products and how they affect the environment. And so we started to realize this challenge when I was there. And I really was inspired by designers that were coming out of London at the time, out of Central St. Martin's. Suzanne Lee is a huge inspiration for me. I came here to be like, okay, well, how do we take these ideas and make them real? And that's been the journey from my MA project forward. And it's been a journey. And I'm a privilege that a lot of these early designers that were my own inspirations are now mentors of mine. And I've learned a lot from them. So ongoing learnings as this whole space grows, no pun intended.
No, I love that. Definitely. I also want to ask you, you describe your biomaterial as a different class of material. So I would like to know, how is that difference to other plant-based or grown materials such as mycelium, for example? What's the difference between that?
Yeah, so I think one is, so conceptually, actually, all these new materials are quite different than predecessors. And I think the initial reaction was, hey, these are like, use a familiar term like leather as a way to make it more understandable. Like, you're replacing a leather, because people understand what leather, wool, cotton, what they are, because we've had them around for hundreds of years. So you need that to an extent. But what we've seen is there's a fallacy in doing that as well, in that you're ultimately comparing something that is, the properties are different, with an incumbent material. So the expectations just get completely misaligned, where they're like, okay, it's a replacement for leather, but it's not, doesn't feel exactly like leather, and it doesn't behave exactly like leather. So you're doing a bad job. And it's like, no, actually, these are really new and can help us design products differently. And we need to approach them that way. From a really nerdy material science level, why is it a new class of materials? Basically, again, it's a non-woven at the end of the day, but it's a new form of natural non-woven that is formed at such like a fine scale that this combination of this sort of macro textile and these really micro fibers becomes this whole new structural category. And those of us that have spent a lot of time in textiles, the structure, the fiber structure, this ends up really making what those end properties are. And so it's important to separate them out and say like, hey, this is a really fundamentally different class of materials, and it behaves differently. You design it differently, and it's going to look a bit different, so that we can, how we do that, it's going to depend on the application. But that's why we're trying to be clear that like, hey, let's take this opportunity of working with something that really is quite new and celebrate that versus trying to fit it into a box.
That's great. I love it.
That's really interesting. And the other thing we were sort of talking earlier, that obviously at WSM, we've been tracking how sort of fiber industry is really shifting quite a lot. And the man-made cellulosic materials really are quite a fast growing area in the industry. I think there's a lot of collaboration going on between a lot of the players in that space and a lot of investment to scale up. And obviously, we're talking about the cellulosics, in this case, coming from trees or from, and also from cotton waste from the industry as well. The bacteria that you use produces a nanocellulose, which is compared to wood or cotton, for example. But what are the particular benefits of a nanocellulose fiber?
Great question. So first and foremost, cellulose is awesome. And I think everybody's woken up to that. And it's funny because that we didn't really... Well, we did. I've been speaking to a lot of scientists, and they're like, yeah, if plastics weren't invented, we would have had a whole host of cellulosic technologies by now, because that's what we were doing 100 years ago. So it's interesting that we kind of shifted back And it's great because cellulose is the natural building block of the main building block of the natural world. And it's everywhere for a reason, because it naturally feeds into the Earth's own systems for circularity. So it degrades very readily in the environment. It forms pretty efficiently by multiple organisms, as you mentioned, plants. And so it's natural that we're seeing kind of different spectrums coming in. Nanocellulose is different from these mostly because of its size. So it's a really, really, really small fiber. So these bacteria, you can't even see them under normal microscopes. They're that small. So these fibers are, because they're so small and they're very fine and very strong, they have sort of this ability to bind to each other and create these really like strong locking together, which makes them sort of a natural adhesive, basically, because they stick together. And so you can create these really strong structures using these tiny fibers without having to add in other binders. And that's why nanocellulose is really interesting. It's also because of that fineness and that purity, light passes through really easily. So you get transparency. It has a really smooth touch because they're not detectable to the human sense of touch. And so it fundamentally changes the properties. Also, from a sustainability standpoint, cellulosics are great. We can't keep making plant cellulose for like apparel and for materials. We need that farmland for food. And ultimately, we're going to start seeing this. Cotton uses an incredible amount of water. And regenerated cellulosics, which are a huge step forward, also use quite a bit of energy. And we're hoping to actually feed into those cycles. So these materials could go into that as well. They just have sort of different properties. So you could make different types of materials with those fibers.
That was going to be my next question. So you've answered that already. And there are some really interesting things going on in the cellulosics. I saw a really interesting innovation called Ruby, which is a cellulose material that's made from pollution, so carbon capture. So it's a really interesting space, isn't it? There's really a lot of room for innovation in the cellulosics of all types.
Yeah, Ruby was on the Fashion for Good program with us last year, and they're doing really cool science on how to make cellulosics. And I see a world where there could be collaborations in the future, combining a lot of our technologies. And I really see that future world being an ecosystem of all these different technologies for different applications and building a beautiful and more circular world.
That's a great answer.
I would like to move a bit back to that consumer perception that we were talking about earlier. So you define very clear that this is a new type of material. I love actually your approach. And I want to understand a bit more, how do you think the consumer reaction will be to wear bacteria? So I'm sure you face that quite a lot. So it will be interesting to have the consumer, the random consumer's reaction to it. And also, how do you think they will classify it? So as you said, it's nothing that they known before. So do you think they will classify it as regenerative, vegan, plastic-free? In what sort of family do you think consumers will place this material?
So it's an interesting question that we've been kind of tackling as we plan out how this material gets in the world. I think the challenge is there isn't really one answer. And so I think what we're going to end up doing is focusing more on a product standpoint. So it's really honing into, hey, we're not making one material. We're making 1,000 different materials. How can we build out our product categories to reflect the needs for different product groups and really designing a material for that product application and honing in on the characteristics that matter in that particular case? And so in terms of the bacteria side, we're talking, I guess, more broadly now around microbial materials, because actually we are seeing a breadth from, you know, all sides of different microbial fibers coming out. And we will no doubt start to experiment with those as well in these materials and how we can work them together. But also, again, there aren't bacteria in the end material. So I think the clarity is trying to explain like, hey, this is a way of making using like working with microbes. It's like fermentation. And at the end of the day, we have fermentation in our lives already. We eat yogurt. Yogurt is a bacterial fermentation. Like any sort of fermented food that you can think of, especially a lot of sort of vegetarian and vegan options are made from microbial processes. So ultimately it's no different. And right now we're using edible bacteria. So they're completely safe. It's just a matter of context and familiarizing people that actually we're surrounded by this stuff already. It's just we're utilizing it a bit differently.
So if you're someone who's into kombucha, for example, then you shouldn't have a problem with with those materials.
No, exactly. If you're drinking kombucha, you're drinking these guys every day. And yeah, and I think that's something, like, the bacteria was isolated from kombucha tea originally, and the process is very different than making kombucha. But ultimately, we've learned a lot from that process, and there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit like changing the consumer's mindset. I remember when one of the sustainable development was bubble gum, salts made out of bubble gum. Some people were like, wow, have they been true or things like that? And it's like, no, absolutely not. It's like the leftovers from the production. So it's changing the consumer's mentality, really, and educate them, I guess. It will land up to be there. And then following up what you said about, we design a product, so this material will be for a particular product. I would like to ask you, what other products besides footwear you see this material happening?
So initially, we're looking at any application that you would have a non-woven today. So non-wovens that exist in the world today are leather, synthetic leather, coated textiles. There's other types of non-woven textiles. So first, as we're scaling, because we don't have a whole lot of this material just yet, but we're planning to grow that, is focusing on, you know, small goods. So accessories, footwear, but we're also looking at applications, you know, within interiors, within automotive, like anywhere that you use those types of materials today, you could use ours. So it's just a matter of kind of phasing in different product categories over time.
Sounds great. And when do you think this will begin to hit the market? I guess it's a $1 million question, but I'm sure you have like a time frame.
Yeah. So I think if you look at mycelium, for example, there was a lot bubbling under the surface for a while there, and you're starting to see those products come out in the world, which is really exciting. And I think there's a curve, right? So there's almost like there's a lot happening, and you'll start seeing a few launches here. And then once that tips over, it's going to move a lot quicker. And for us, it's actually no different. And in fact, we can scale a bit quicker than some of those prior materials, simply because, one, we've learned from their mistakes, and they've been very open about them. And I really honestly appreciate those guys for sharing all their mistakes with us, because that way we can actually get this next round of materials out quicker. But also with nanocellulose, it's produced at scale already. So it's used in like beauty applications. So, you know, those like biocellulose face masks, they're like these like really like hydrating masks. That's nanocellulose, actually. And so it's produced for that. It's produced for medical applications, for food. So there is actually production of this existing. And we can tap into a lot of that as we're scaling up. So we're not completely starting from scratch. So it's more about getting the product right. And we're doing that through partnerships, through working directly with brands, because they know the customers better than we do. And it's really about getting those first applications right and making sure we get all the work, all the kinks out in production, because there is a lot of unknowns. You know, this is new, true innovation, and we learn new things every day. So it's trying to get all of the things sorted out so that when we're at market, we can actually scale quickly.
You're listening to Create Tomorrow. I'm your host, Helen Palmer, Head of Materials at WGSN, and I'm joined by Lucila Saldana, Footwear and Accessories Editor at WGSN. On this episode, our special guest is Jen Keane, the CEO and founder of Modern Synthesis, a biomaterial innovation company that develops new generation regenerative materials for the fashion and lifestyle industries. I asked Jen about the stigmas around synthetic biology and GMO materials.
It's really interesting, because I've learned a lot through over the years of speaking with people. And the original project, which was This is GMO, I talked a little bit about my presentation. That project was to show the potential of these new technologies to actually make, you know, sustainability benefits, like, you know, reducing dye waste by growing color in. And we're already seeing that from Colorifix and a few others that are using genetically modified technologies. It's been a shift, but it also depends on who you talk to. Certain markets care a lot more about that than others. I did a few exhibitions where most of the people that I talked to were like, cool, that sounds great, let's do it. And then when you talk to some brands, there's a lot more hesitancy, especially in countries that have stricter laws about GMOs, for good reason. I think there should be regulation. Like, these are not technologies that we should just be doing without questioning or controlling them. I think it will change over time. That being said, they're a little bit further off than people think. There's incredible technologies that we're developing now that require infrastructure before you can even do anything about them. So like all these wonderful things, like you got to build out the systems for them to work before we can even dabble in that, which is why we're really focusing on the natural forms of the bacteria and the materials produced by that in the initial stages. But as we grow, we want to be honest and have these conversations with everyone that we're working with to see how we feel. The one thing, though, is most materials, there's a lot of materials in the world that are GMOs already. So 90% of the world's cotton is genetically modified. And I think there's a conversation that needs to be had publicly about these things. Is it well managed? Not all the time. And so I think it's putting regulations in place, both on how the technologies are used, but also how they're exploited. Because I think most of the problems come with the human side of these technologies.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also the prefix bio is also quite interesting, isn't it? Because I think that these new biomaterials, they encompass such a lot of different materials. They all have a very unique blueprint. And I think that with the word bio, the sort of general term can just mean anything that's from nature. And also there's a lot of greenwashing around, I would say, biomaterials as well. And you've got to think about when you're replacing an existing material, whether that new biomaterial is more sustainable in the long run. Are there any potential sort of downsides to biomaterials, or what are the sort of challenges or elements that are perhaps less sustainable than we might imagine if someone talks about the word bio? Is there anything that you've sort of come across that you think you have to sort of tread quite carefully around?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, bio can mean anything. And currently it is pretty much used for almost anything. If it's made from a plant, it's called a biomaterial. If it's somewhat derived from a plant, it's called a biomaterial. And I think that's critical to understand the differences. So like things like bioplastics, not a very regulated world. Like ultimately they're still, a lot of them are still plastic. So you still have the pollution challenge of that, even if they are better. And I'm not saying it's not worth doing, because they are better. If you're shifting from a petrochemical source to a bio source that is a sustainable feedstock, by all means, that helps. But at the end of the day, they're still plastics. And so I think you see people kind of choosing one issue and kind of ignoring the other one. And the same with natural. Just because it's natural doesn't mean that it's actually good for the environment, like cotton, for example, or even sometimes natural rubbers and latex. Like they're like, oh, it's great. There's a reason why we stopped using it years ago. The limiting factor, but also there's like challenges from a sourcing standpoint to making that much material from it sustainably. Ultimately, there is no, you know, one most sustainable material in the entire world. It's really about being honest about the different metrics and making sure that it is at least continually better than the incumbents, to a point that we can reach a really sort of carbon neutral, but also pollution free production environment.
Sure. And do you think though, then it's about designing products around those biomaterials so that, as you said, that you're not looking at, say, a conventional leather sneaker or an alternative petrol-made material sneaker and then something made of nanocellulose? Is it the fact that probably the way that you would make that product, the way it would you would use it, would that be slightly different for the fact that you are looking at a different product? So maybe the metrics would be different. Is that kind of how you see things?
Yeah. And I think it also comes down to when we talk a little bit about sort of how it will shape design, I think it's how you'll design products differently. I imagine that our materials will be used with another type of great biomaterial in different ways, and you'll have different combinations. And it's important to think holistically, or even we could have multiple of our materials that are designed slightly differently in different parts of the product. And that's where we need to get a little bit smarter as designers in really thinking about that holistic product, and also what materials are needed for those different areas, even of a product or different specific product categories. And so we can develop those now and take this more holistic approach and design our testing and our expectations based off of that as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I suppose as well, because a lot of products are multi-component or multi-material, so you've got to think holistically about the product, all the other parts of that product and how they work together, how they perform, and then also post-consumer, how
those products might be disposed of or recycled, for example. So yeah, there's such a lot to consider with every material that exists, and especially these really exciting new ones. Fascinating.
Yeah, great. And I have a question. So here at WCSN, we like to say that all these biomaterials or plant-based materials come as a replacement for petrol-based synthetics. What are your thoughts around it? Because obviously we talk about thinking the product from the beginning, but do you think that's still the role for them? What are your general views around it? And what do you think are the biggest trends or macro trends that are behind these changes and these new developments?
Oh man, so many things. Again, with the product focus, we can go in different sort of directions with it. And I think that's the exciting bit for us, is one side is displacing synthetics, but I think it's also understanding, like, what are those synthetics? Why are they there in the first place? Like, what are they doing? And that means different things in different product applications. And some, it's because it's lightweight. In our case, that's a hero of these types of cellulosic materials, is we can make strong, lightweight materials that you couldn't do with a leather back in the day, or even now. Or is it about repellency? If it's about repellency of water or sort of abrasion, then you need to optimize for that. And so it's about designing a material that's, you know, resistant to abrasion. Or is it because it's cool looking and transparent and it looks technical? That's a design feature that you're replacing. And so I think it's looking holistically at, like, what is that material used for? Or is it cost? Honestly, like with synthetics, a lot of it was cost. You could extract a bunch of oil, you could make really cheap materials, and therefore you could get a better margin. And cost is a challenge with biomaterials, because, you know, you're competing against the incumbent, which has had a lot of time to get to that scale. And so that is kind of working in where you can as you grow the technologies.
Amazing. I was going to talk to you a bit about sort of going forward in the future. And I know that you've recently raised quite a significant amount of funding to support and extend your work further. And you have your brand new microfactory in London. I was going to ask, in terms of sort of onward investing, how hard is it to get investors on board for biomaterial products that probably won't get to the mass market for, you know, could be as much as a decade? So how do you have those conversations? Because obviously in the fashion industry, lifestyle industries, a lot of brands and companies, they want to be able to deliver newness over a short period of time, because we're in that cycle of dropping products and launches. So, you know, how do you approach something as interesting and new as a biomaterial, and how do you sort of form those partnerships, and how easy is it to get people on board to invest in the longer term for the end goal?
I mean, the good news for us is we're not the first generation of these materials. And I think the first round, you know, Bolt Threads, Microworks, Modern Meadow, these guys really proved that, hey, people want this and the fashion industry needs it. And I think we've seen enormous amount of investment. MII just put out a report about sort of the investment in this space. And so there is a ton of interest, and it's growing within our space. I think the challenge is, yeah, more traditional investors, it's trying to find the right partners and investors for this type of work, because most of, like, the sort of the VC model was built off of tech companies, right? Tech companies, you don't need a lot of stuff. When you're making materials, it's a very sort of capital based business. You're making physical things. Obviously, we're reducing that capital cost significantly by choices that we make. But at the same time, you need people, you need researchers, you need space. And so it is different timelines. And so the investors we have on board understand that. At the same time, the advancements allow us to actually move a lot quicker than previous. So it's a bit more palatable to investors that I've started to see some of the material innovations over the last few years start to get picked up by big brands. It's just finding the right match, because some investors, you know, they're excited about fashion, but they don't understand the deep technology of biology. And sometimes you need those different skill sets from investors versus, you know, someone that's really deep tech but is scared of fashion. So sometimes there's an education piece that we have to do to help them understand the big picture of what we're trying to do.
Sure. Yes. I think I saw the same report from MII. I think there's more than 100 biomaterial innovators now. I think there's been quite an escalation in the last few years. And it's quite amazing to see how that's sort of cross-referenced across, as you said, mycelium and microbe materials and all the other types of recycled materials. So yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it, that we are definitely seeing a real escalation and an investment in these materials. But if you're a brand and you're interested, what kind of considerations should they be sort of looking at in terms of choosing the right partner to sort of to invest in and test and pilot products to market? What sort of conversations are had with brands around this and the expectations of these biomaterials?
Definitely. I think we've learned a lot through conversations with brands over the last few years. And I think the first step is honesty about capabilities in-house with brands as well. So brands, you know, big brands, small brands, high fashion, luxury versus sportswear, they have very different needs. And so I think it's important to understand and have that conversation up front about like, what do they need? And also what support do they have available within their organization to really partner? Because this is a true partnership. If you're going to work with a startup like us or an early stage biomaterial company, this isn't, you know, a traditional supplier relationship, because we can't afford to do that. We have limited funding. We're moving fast. And so if you want to be the first in this space or even have access to these materials, which is what has been the biggest struggle, is just capacity. We don't have the ability to work with everybody. So it's really about, like, you know, if you want to get in here, it's about honesty and also commitment and being able to take a little bit of a risk as well, because, you know, we're out there trying new things and trying to build this, but it doesn't work without the industry support. And so what we need from brands is really that commitment and the ability to stand up and say, like, look, we're willing to support these guys through, whether that's, you know, legal contractual offtake agreements, through funding R&D, doing developments together, and even more of the storytelling of like, hey, let's launch a product together to share this message with the world. We need those commitments. And so I think that's something that we talk to brands really up front, where it's like, hey, we want to partner with you, but we want to be real partners and we want to go on this journey together.
Yeah, that's really insightful. And I'm sure that I think everyone's on this sort of learning journey about biomaterials, aren't they? And I think that it's about everyone upskilling and sharing and sort of getting quite transparent conversations about how these materials are iterating and building on that. So yeah, I think it is quite an exciting area that you're in. I was going to ask you about standards and tests, but I think we've covered that earlier when we were talking about the materials being quite different and needing their own sort of parameters. But I know that Lucy's got a few questions about scalability.
Yes. So perfect beginning. Like, we talk about these partnerships and how important it is, because you talk about capacity, which obviously for us is a big thing. So when do you see that? So actually, because you have all the insight from the industry, I think that's also is really interesting. It's like the mixing the science with the industry, with the design, right? So you have all the insight to understand how the industry works on a mass production level. So having that experience, how do you see and when that these materials are able to be scalable in terms of capacity and cost-effective developments for brands to start to implement these?
Big question.
Big question. No pressure.
No pressure. Exactly. Sorry about that. No pressure.
I think one of the learnings that we took away from the first generation of biomaterials is the importance of scaling not only quickly, but also smartly. And I think that's something that we really took to heart, is making sure that you at each step assess the risks at the next one really well and do that well. Otherwise, you overpromise. And so really what we're focused on at the moment is getting those materials to a point where we are ready to do that big leap to the next. I think in the next few years, you're going to start seeing these in the market, but then the scaling really happens quickly after that. So it's really like the big is sort of the 5 to 10 years out, you're going to see a huge boom from now. And it might even start a bit sooner than that. because there are, you know, other materials in the space. There's other materials like mycelium is a couple years ahead. So I think you're going to see like a few waves of different material innovations coming out and then getting to scale quite quickly, because there's a lot happening in the background right now. And so you're kind of getting all the wheels turning, working everything out. But I'm optimistic because there's a lot of investment happening in this space and we're all focused on scale. And so I'm confident that we can do it in a reasonable amount of time. But even then, like, we're still, you know, a tiny fraction of the market. There's so many materials that are made, like the billions and billions of meters of synthetic textiles and leathers that are produced right now. Like, we've got a lot of work to do, but you will be able to access it hopefully within the next sort of 5 to 10 years on a mass scale.
So to close, I want to know from you, Jen, about what you predict for the future. At WDSN, we've been tracking biodesign and biomaterials for a while now, and what was speculative thinking is becoming a reality. What other innovations do you think will be on the market, say, 10 to 20 years from now?
So many things. Okay, a couple of big trends that I really like I think the computational side. So with AI at the moment, this is going to have really big effects on how we design everything. And so this is something really interesting and something we've explored as well, and which is interesting with biomaterials is you actually can have a higher level control about that. And I foresee creatives starting to get a lot more involved in that process, which will be great. I'd like to see some of the more like social sides of this actually coming to play out as well. There's a lot of great designers looking at sort of the social impacts of biodesign, of these technologies changing the way that we approach value systems. That's something that I'd really like to change in the industry, and being able to source different sources of value from how something is created, linking it back to the original creator a little bit better. Again, technologies can enable that in a higher level, understanding what is rare, what is luxury, and really rethinking those things. I think that's where some of the speculative work could be really interesting and applied in a few years' time.
Wow, that's fascinating. So really democratizing concepts around value and products.
Yes, I would like to see that democratization of design.
Amazing. Thank you to Jen Keane, the CEO and founder of Modern Synthesis, for taking time to speak to us today. If you're a WGSN subscriber, you'll find reports covering many of the topics we touched upon on our platform. If you want to find out how to subscribe, head over to WGSN.com to discover how you can get access to our service. We're constantly publishing new content focusing on how we can design a brighter, better future for our industries, including food and drink, interiors, beauty, fashion, and consumer tech. You can subscribe on all major podcast platforms, and if you like what you've heard, why not leave us a rating and review on iTunes? We'll be back in 2 weeks for our next episode. You can catch the CEO of WGSN, Carla Bisacci, next week on our other podcast, Lives of Tomorrow, where we will be looking at the future of travel, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.